Muchas gracias a todos por estar aquí. My name is Peter Florence, and it is a great honor to introduce a very old friend of mine to talk to you this afternoon. He is one of the most brilliant narrative historians in the English language. His study of the 20th century, politically, militarily, and socially, has been a marvel of the last 20 years. Please give a very warm welcome to Andrew Roberts. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honour to be invited to address you this afternoon, and thank you very much indeed, Peter, for those kind words. The last time that I was in Cartagena was 30 years ago, when I had a job deep sea diving, trying to find $600 million worth of Colombian emeralds and silver, which sunk on Spanish treasure ships in the winter of 1703. And I didn't find it, and so I had to become a writer instead, and here I am 3 decades later, and it's a great honour. I'd like to speak to you today about the Second World War. Even though South America was the only continent not to be devastated by the Second World War, the only inhabited continent not to be devastated by the Second World War. Of course, there were elements of the Second World War that affected South America, the Battle of the River Plate, of course, in Uruguay, and down in the Falklands Islands, there were some important naval battles, and quite a few Nazis escaped to Paraguay. But other than that, this was the continent that managed to escape the disasters of and the tragedies of the Second World War. But nonetheless, they did, I think, manage to this great conflict of 6 years, costing over 50 million lives and costing trillions of dollars, did manage to give some important, serious, and substantial lessons to mankind, which people in every continent would be well to remember. And the argument that I would like to put forward today is that the reason that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis lost the Second World War was that, again and again, Hitler put his ideological beliefs, his Nazism, his fanatical fascism, before the best interests of the German army, of the Wehrmacht, of what Germany needed to do strategically in order to try to win that war. And one sees this at its most powerful, really, in the invasion of Russia that took place on the 22nd of June 1941, in which he believed that because of the automatic, the instinctive superiority of the Aryan race, of the German people, the Anglo-Saxons, because they were superior to the Slavs who they were invading in Russia, and indeed every other race in the world at that time, that he was therefore automatically going to win the great struggle that he unleashed with his invasion of Russia called Operation Barbarossa. And the extent to which he believed the Aryan people were superior can be seen in a series of statements that he made, comic today, perhaps, but at the time meant entirely seriously, that in his headquarters in the Wolfschanze, the wolf's lair in East Prussia, 1,000 miles behind the, more than 1,000 miles behind the front line, he said this to Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, And it seems almost absurd, and certainly very incongruous on a lovely, sunny, hot day like this. But one has to remember that on the 12th of August 1942, when he made these remarks, he was speaking with regard to the not just sub-zero temperatures that his forces had to deal with in Russia, but temperatures of up to minus 45 degrees centigrade that these soldiers, many of whom were given far too little in the way of winter clothing to fight the elements, let alone the Russians. He said this: "Having to change into long trousers was always a misery to me. Even with a temperature of 10 below zero, I used to go about in lederhosen." Lederhosen being those short leather trousers that were popular in Austria at the time. "The feeling of freedom they give you is wonderful. Abandoning my shorts was one of the biggest sacrifices I had to make. Anything up to 5 degrees below zero, I didn't even notice. Quite a number of young people of today already wear shorts all the year round. It's just a question of habit. In the future, I shall have an SS Highlands Brigade wearing lederhosen." This lets you into, gives you a tiny sense of quite how absurd, how ludicrous, how ridiculous Adolf Hitler's attitude was towards the horrific snows of Russia that were going to engulf his armies. And August 1942 was the very month in which his armies began to invest Stalingrad, a massive battle that was to take 6 months and to cost the lives of over 300,000 Germans. And the result was, as the Italian journalist Curzio Malaparte wrote in his superb 1946 novel, Caput, utterly devastating. He was sitting in the Europeiska Cafe in Warsaw, watching German wounded come back from the Eastern Front. And he wrote this about it afterwards. "Suddenly I was struck with horror and realized that they had no eyelids. I'd already seen soldiers with lidless eyes on the platform of the Minsk station a few days previously on my way back from Smolensk. The ghastly cold of that winter had the strangest consequences. Thousands and thousands of soldiers had lost their limbs, thousands and thousands had their ears, their noses, their fingers, and their sexual organs ripped off by the frost. Many had lost their hair, many had lost their eyelids. Singed by the cold, the eyelid dropped off like a piece of dead skin. Their future was only lunacy." So, ladies and gentlemen, how was it that the German staff, reputedly at the time one of the great, most efficient organizations in military history, how could the German General Staff have come to the position whereby they were losing soldiers because they had not given enough winter clothing, because to the extent that their eyelids were falling off because of the frost? And the answer, again and again, comes back to Adolf Hitler and his closest supporters, their absolute total assumption that the Aryan people, the Übermensch, the German people and other Nordic peoples were racially superior to the rest of the world, and particularly to the Slavic people of Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and various other parts of the then USSR. And when one also looks at his other assumptions, his other racial and ideological assumptions, they too form a greater understanding for why the Germans lost the Second World War. For Britain, which he believed to be populated by people who were also Aryans, Anglo-Saxons, he failed to believe that there was ever going to be the necessity of a long-term war, of a war that was going to last, as it did, 6 years. He believed that the Anglo-Saxon people, racially the same as the German people, would make peace with Germany as soon as it was clear that the Germans had won on the continent. And so as a result, he failed to take even the most basic precautions necessary to fight a long-term war against the United Kingdom. At the beginning of the war, in September 1939, Hitler only had 50 operational U-boats to fight against the United Kingdom. This was clearly the best way to destroy Britain and British independence, to sink the vast amounts of food and other natural resources that needed to be brought in to this island, Britain, when the war broke out. And yet, even though at the end of the war he had 463 U-boats, all bottled up in the Baltic at the time, right at the beginning of the war, that was a, he only had 50. Had he believed that he was going to have to try to invade the United Kingdom, he would have had advanced plans worked out for this. As it was, even up to September 1940, at the time of the Battle of Britain, the great air battle taking place over the United Kingdom, there were still arguments taking place between the German Air Force and the German Navy and the German Army over where the attack should take place, when and how it should be undertaken. Admiral Raeder, who was in charge of the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, was still having severe internal struggles against General Brauchitsch, who was the commander of the Wehrmacht, whose overall job it was to try to invade the United Kingdom. These things should have all been organized far earlier, years earlier, certainly months earlier, but they were not, because the Germans and the Nazis in particular, the people who took the ultimate decisions in that Reich, the Third Reich, were not racially and ideologically opposed to Britain in the way that they ought to have been. You then come on to the very concept of why it was that the invasion of Russia ever took place at all. These decisions were taken again by Hitler and a tiny group of fellow Nazis. Whenever the German generals were asked about these subjects, they tended to agree with whatever they were ordered to think about by the politicians. They were not brave men. They were far greater strategists than Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, who in the First World War, only rose to the rank of corporal, although he did win the Iron Cross first class and also second class. He was obviously brave on the battlefield. Nonetheless, he was in no sense a grand strategist. And yet, when faced with men far superior to him in terms of grand strategy, men like Heinz Guderian or Erwin Rommel or Erich von Manstein or Gerd von Rundstedt, these men he would listen to at his headquarters, the Volkskanzler. He would listen to them perhaps sometimes for an hour, and then at the end of it he would decide to do precisely what he had originally intended to do at the beginning of the meeting. This was part of the Führer principle, the concept that the Führer was infallible, something that was absolutely innate to the Third Reich, to the political concept of the Third Reich, and something, therefore, that he could never be proved to be wrong. And so, when, on the 25th of August 1940, a Heinkel 111 bomber got itself lost over the city of London and bombed London, Winston Churchill took the opportunity to bomb Berlin. This was something that Hitler had said would never happen, that it was impossible for it to take place. And so he was proved wrong, something that went to the very heart of the whole concept of the Nazi state. And so as a result, even though at that time the Germans were on the verge of knocking out vital RAF aerodromes at places like Lynn and Biggin Hill and Manston, instead the Luftwaffe turned to bomb London, something they concentrated on for the whole of the rest of that month, through into September and October 1940 and onwards. Instead of trying to destroy the RAF, they instead bombed the east end of London, the docks and various other important areas. This, too, was a political decision, primarily, rather than one that was driven by grand strategy and the need, militarily, to crush the United Kingdom. And then when one looks at the decision, at the reasons for attacking Russia, there, too, you have a series of driving desiderata that are primarily political. His hatred of the Jews, over 50% of the Jewish population of Europe lived in Russia, in the USSR, in June 1941. And so his excessive loathing of the Jews, his desire to eliminate the Jewish people in Europe, was a driving force behind it. Entirely ideological. His hatred, of course, also of Bolshevism, the Bolsheviks against whom he had fought on street corners from the 1920s onwards, even though he had made a short-term, entirely cynical Nazi-Soviet pact with Stalin in late August 1939, he felt that the time had finally come when he was going to be able to have, in his words, a final reckoning against the Bolshevik state. He believed also that because the Bolsheviks were Slavs, he would be able to merely, in his words, kick in the door and the whole rotten edifice of Russia would fall in. And then there was the desire, the need, for what he called Lebensraum, living space in the East, where the Übermensch, the Aryan people, were going to be able to live. Ladies and gentlemen, none of these are military or grand strategy reasons to attack the Soviet Union. Even if he had managed to hold himself back for very few months after the fall of Yugoslavia and Greece and Crete in the April and May of 1941, he would have been able to have had a more successful attack against the Soviet Union. The Russians themselves had no fewer than 80 warnings that this was going to take place, that the attack was going to take place. On some occasions, including from Richard Sorge, the Russian spy in the German embassy in Tokyo, Stalin was actually given the exact date that the attack was going to take place, the night of the 21st of June 1941, and he still didn't believe it. And so Hitler, in fact, had time to attack the Soviet Union in his own time. What he should have done, instead of launching the attack so early, was to have knocked the British out of Egypt. It could have been done with a fraction of the forces that he unleashed on Russia. In Operation Barbarossa, he actually sent more than 3 million men, 3 million troops, into Russia. And yet, when in 1942, the following year, General Erwin Rommel was commanding the Afrika Korps, he only actually had 4 German divisions against the 180 divisions that were used against Russia. With a tiny fraction of those forces that he attacked Russia with, he could have knocked Britain out of the Middle East. As it was, by November 1942, at the Battle of El Alamein, he had got within, Rommel had got within 60 miles of Alexandria in Egypt. And so he would then have managed to have taken Iraq and Iran, and to have closed Britain off from 80% of its oil, the vital prerequisite, the petrol needed to fuel the tanks and the aircraft that Britain needed, and thereby knock Britain effectively out of the Second World War. That would have been the time after that to have attacked Russia, not least because he would have been able to have come from the south as well as just to have attacked from the west. He would have been able to have moved up into Astrakhan and the various other parts of the Soviet Union. He needed to cut Russia off from 80% of its oil, which was in the Caucasus. But no, because of the Jews, because of the Bolsheviks, and because of Lebensraum, he instead decided to attack Russia too early. Only 6 months after that, he took the decision, during the invasion of Russia, there too, again and again, he made ideological decisions which worked against the best interests of the Wehrmacht, of the German army, for ideological reasons. Instead of attempting to get the Ukraine onto his side, something that was a distinct possibility in 1941. One mustn't forget that the Ukraine had been viciously ill-treated by the Muscovite government. Some 6 million Ukrainians had been starved to death in the 1920s and 30s in entirely politically organized and artificial famines. Instead of trying to bring them on side, he made only the most Potemkin efforts to do that, something that was to prove disastrous later on when the Ukrainians proved to be superb partisan fighters behind the German lines. The reason that he didn't was because he despised the Ukrainians as much as he despised the Russians, because they too were Slavs. And then, 6 months after the invasion of Russia, Hitler made his next absolutely cataclysmic error, and again, I would argue, an error made not on military or strategic principles, but entirely on political and ideological ones. This fanatical racist believed that the United States would not be able to fight a successful war against the German people, against the against Nazi Germany and her allies, because he believed that the American administration of President Roosevelt were dominated by blacks and Jews. He couldn't, of course, have looked very closely at the actual personnel of the American administration, Roosevelt's administration, to have believed this. Nonetheless, he thought that it would be impossible, as he told his closest entourage, it would be impossible for America to land any troops in Europe before the year 1970. Of course, as it was on the 9th of November 1942 that 150,000 American troops landed in North Africa with Operation Torch, and many, many others, of course, millions in the end, were to follow them. But when Joachim von Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, met a group of Italians, Italian journalists, almost immediately after the German declaration of war on America on the 11th of December 1941, he was to say this. I know them, Ribbentrop said about America. I know their country. A country devoid of culture, devoid of music. Above all, a country without soldiers, a people who will never be able to decide the war from the air. When has a Jewified nation like that ever become a race of fighters and flying aces? In fact, by the calendar year 1944, when the British produced 28,000 aircraft, warplanes, the Russians 40,000 warplanes, and the Germans 40,000 warplanes, the United States produced no fewer than 98,000 warplanes, almost as much as the rest of the world put together. And, of course, America was, as far as Germany was concerned at that time, an uninvadable country. He had declared war, also, without any actual need to. He had not, in 1937, at the time of the signing of the German-Japanese anti-Comintern pact, made any promises to the Japanese that he was going to declare war if the Japanese attacked America as it did. So this was an unforced error on behalf of Hitler, and again one that was taken primarily on a massive and absurd misunderstanding of the United States. And all the more extraordinary because he himself had fought across from, in the trenches, across from American units in the First World War. The contribution of the Americans to victory in the First World War was something that he knew all about, and yet he still continued to make that that extraordinary error. And this, as I say, was due to ideological and political, as much to as any other kind of reason. Then there's the whole concept, after having gone into war, having declared war against the Japanese, there's the whole concept of why on earth he didn't coordinate more closely with the Japanese, his allies. When one thinks of the two opportunities, first, of course, prior to at the time of Operation Barbarossa, when had the Japanese attacked Russia from the east, at the same time that he was attacking with his 3 million men Russia from the west, it could have proved fatal for the USSR. As it was, on the 18th of October 1941, Joseph Stalin, the dictator of Russia, made his personal train ready to take him beyond the Urals, back beyond the Urals, near Katrinburg, to the Urals, from Moscow. And had that happened, he had the train made ready, he went down to the station, he decided not to take the journey. Had that happened, the entire Russian war effort would, once the news got out, would have been deeply demoralized. He didn't do this partly because of 30 Siberian divisions that were brought back from Siberia to defend Moscow, something that couldn't have happened had the Japanese attacked at the same time. Equally, had the Germans and the Japanese got together with regard to the Indian Ocean, they could have, at the time of the Japanese threat to the British Empire in India, also there have caused terrible dislocation of the British war effort. It didn't happen because the Germans and the Japanese failed to coordinate. They didn't even give each other information about anti-tank weaponry and other such useful information. This was also partly because Hitler despised the Japanese racially. At the time of the anti-Comintern pact, he did get his scientists to look at various Japanese skulls to try and prove that they were like Aryans, but this was not something that actually he was convinced with by, and neither were any of the other senior Nazis. And of course, finally, we come to the next ideological, political, catastrophic error that Hitler was to make, which was during the Second World War, which was to indulge in his loathing, his hatred, his desire to eliminate the Jewish people in Europe, even though that too did not advance the German war effort one iota. When one looks at the number of people who were working in German factories between 1939, 39 million, and 1944, 29 million, you see a 26% collapse in the number of people working in German industry. 26%. And at exactly that same time, Hitler pursued a policy which led to the industrialized annihilation of 6 million of the most intelligent, hard-working, and well-educated people in his Reich. It was a suicidal mistake to have done this, and something that was entirely pursued because of his obsessive racist views. He himself knew that Jews made superb fighting men. He had his Iron Cross first class came as the direct result of his being proposed by his adjutant of his regiment, who was himself Jewish. He nonetheless pursued this policy, which was also to dislocate rail and other communications which could have been used to fight fight on the Eastern Front. He was to use thousands of SS soldiers, of course, in this, but he was to deny himself primarily the chance of using a huge population of brilliant people. And how brilliant they were was later to be proved when his policies turned out to lead directly to the Allies' acquisition of the nuclear bomb. I once had lunch with Winston Churchill's assistant war secretary, a splendid man called Lieutenant General Sir Ian Jacob. And he said to me at the end of the lunch, you know, I often think about why we won the Second World War, and I rather think that the ultimate reason, is that our German scientists were cleverer than their German scientists. And in a sense, that is true. When one looks at the number of Nobel Prizes that were won by the Germans between 1901 and Hitler's coming to power in 1933, the numbers are extraordinary. Germany had 25 Nobel laureates in physics and chemistry against America's 5. After the war, in the 50 years after the war, as a direct result of the brain drain that came because of Hitler's policies, Germany won only 13 Nobel Prizes to the United States' 67. And the list of German scientists, yes, they had Werner Heisenberg and Werner von Braun. But when one thinks, now, not all these people are Jewish, but they are all people who contributed to the nuclear bomb and were in some way refugees from Hitler's Europe, 1933 to 1939. They included Albert Einstein, Leo Szilard, Hans Bethe, Edward Teller, Eugene Wigner, Emilio Segre, Enrico Fermi, Stanislaw Ulam, and of course, one also would add Niels Bohr escaping Denmark in 1943 to that list. So by denying himself the scientific genius necessary to create a bomb of his own, Hitler's Nazism led him to persecute precisely the people who could have prevented his own downfall. On the 4th of February 1942, Berchtesgaden, his home in at the Berghof in Austria, Hitler was discussing, of all things, Hamlet and King Lear with Heinrich Himmler, and he said this: "It's a misfortune that none of our great writers took his subject from German imperial history. our Schiller found nothing better to do than to glorify a Swiss crossbowman. The English, for their part, had a Shakespeare, but the history of this country has supplied Shakespeare, as far as heroes are concerned, only with imbeciles and madmen. Up until recently, it has been assumed, it has been taken for granted, I think, by historians, that Hitler was either an imbecile or a madman. He was either a fool, an idiot, who made all these mistakes just simply because he was a blunderer, or that he was so psychologically disordered that he was incapable of making a rational series of logical decisions. I think this is wrong. He clearly did go mad, but I think towards the end of his life, when he looked certain death in the face, that was very different from the time in 1941 when he made the decisions to invade Russia and to declare war against America. Instead, it isn't because he was an imbecile, it wasn't because he was a madman that he lost the Second World War. The reason that Hitler lost the Second World War was exactly the same one why he unleashed it in the first place, and that was that he was an unregenerate, fanatical Nazi. Thank you very much indeed. We have 15 minutes for questions, and if questions are going to be asked in Spanish, could I have a... Can somebody give that gentleman?
Thank you. That was very... Is it working?
Hello?
Yes.
That was a very interesting talk. One simple question. Why did the Hitler not take advantage of Dunkirk?
Very good question. The question was, why didn't Adolf Hitler take advantage of Dunkirk, of the opportunity that he had on the 25th of May 1940 to capture the British Expeditionary Force and large parts of the French army as well? This, it is clear, was not primarily an ideological decision. Many people have argued that it, historians have argued that it was, but as I think I prove finally and completely in my new book, The Storm of War, is in fact we have now a letter from his Chief of Military Operations, Major General Alfred Jodl, who said that he believed that they were going to capture the whole of the British Expeditionary Force. So those people who have argued for many years that Hitler held back the Wehrmacht, the panzers from outside Dunkirk, in the hope that there was going to be some kind of a peace negotiation or anything like that, are quite wrong. The reason, there were many reasons why he, several reasons at least, why he didn't send the panzers into Dunkirk. To name just a few, the forces had already been fighting for a fortnight, having fought himself in the First World War. He knew how exhausting that was for his troops. He was fearful of a counterattack, understandably, because there had been so little in the way of counterattacks up till that time. He didn't like to commit his armor to built-up areas that hadn't gone very well for him in Warsaw and Rotterdam, and he also was advised by Rundstedt not to move into Dunkirk, even though others like Guderian and Kleist and various other panzer generals begged him to. And it was, of course, one of the great early blunders of his war. One has to remember at that stage, though, he was capable of listening to his generals. He listened to Manstein, whose idea it was to effect the sickle cut maneuver through to the English Channel coast, which was a brilliant maneuver which cut off the British Expeditionary Force effectively. And he also believed that Goering was going to be able to crush the British Expeditionary Force before the Royal Navy was going to be able to save it. Again and again, he seems to have believed and followed Goering's advice. Goering also promised him that Berlin was never going to be bombed. He promised him that Stalingrad could be resupplied by air, and made various other promises, all of which turned out to be absurd. But nonetheless, he never sacked Goering, at least until the very end. He was he believed in Goering, partly because Goering was a fanatical Nazi like him. Other generals were sacked on a regular basis. Rundstedt was sacked 4 times in the course of the Second World War. He would constantly move generals to different jobs. Merville was in charge of 4 different put in charge of 4 different theatres in the course of the year 1944. And other generals would be promoted, like Rendulic and Schirner, Merville himself being a good example, Krebs. These men were promoted because of their ideological Nazism, rather than because of how good they were in the as generals. So this was another example of the phenomenon to which I was referring in my speech. Lady, right in the middle there, in the blue dress, if she could be given a.
I wanted to ask, I don't know, perhaps it's a naive question, but there is a silent counter-narrative in what you're saying. All your discourse is why Hitler lost the war, but then why Britain won the war is like the silent counter-discourse. It seems that Britain didn't win the war. I'm sure the British have to be annoyed by your interpretation of the Second World War, and you must have had a not very pleasant commentaries in Britain.
That's a very good question. I'm not sure the British are annoyed about my interpretation. My book became number 2 in the bestseller list, beaten only by Michael Jackson. But it is something
it
I think
means you're red, not light.
I think that it's a that one has to remember, of course, that if one looks at the central, what for me is at least the central statistic of the whole of the Second World War, it is the fact that for every 5 Germans killed in combat in the Second World War, by which I don't mean bombed from the air, I mean soldiers killed on the battlefield, 4 out of the 5 died on the Eastern Front. So there's no way really that Britain can claim to have done much more than successfully to have survived the Second World War and to have helped the reconquest of Germany. It was, she provided magnificent, invaluable help when it came to the convoys helping Russia, the RAF bombing German cities, therefore meaning that something like 70% of the Luftwaffe had to be kept in the West to fight the RAF rather than, and the USAAF, of course, the Americans as well, rather than pounding the Russians on the Eastern Front. She captured 250,000, she and the Americans captured 250,000 troops in Tunisia in May 1943, almost as many as were captured at Stalingrad. I mean, the United Kingdom did provide the time, of course, also in 1940 and 1941 when Russia was an ally of Germany. So in no way would I underestimate the contribution of the United Kingdom of Great Britain to the victory in the Second World War. However, compared to what the Russians did in killing 4 out of 5 German soldiers, this has clearly to be put into its proper historical perspective. Gentleman here, can someone give him a...
This is another naive or elementary question, but outside of the ideological mistakes and disastrous military defeats, how do you explain that such a professional and efficient army, the Wehrmacht, didn't have adequate winter equipment in the Eastern Front? If they would have had it, would it affect significantly what happened there?
The question was about the really what's upsetting the winter clothing in the on the Eastern Front, but also the way in which the most efficient army in the world, the German army in 1939, failed to provide successfully for German troops. I think that obviously I do believe that this mad overconfidence that was engendered largely through the racial assumption that the Slavs were untermensch, were subhuman, and weren't going to be able to fight a long campaign. Even though Leningrad was subjected to a grueling 900-day siege in which 1.1 million people died, both soldiers and civilians, and yet Leningrad held out. Even though the Germans actually captured Stalingrad and were pushed out of it later. And when one visits Stalingrad, it's truly the huge tractor factories that were fought over and various other kinds of factories that were fought over. It makes you sort of dumb with admiration for both sides what they underwent in those grueling months in 1942 and early 1943. And of course, towards the end of the war, there were a few German generals and a few field marshals who were willing to risk their lives attempting to assassinate Adolf Hitler, primarily, of course, on the 20th of July, 1944. But, and historians debate this constantly, it seems to me, an innate problem with totalitarian powers, that they don't have to listen to the generals in the same way that the democratic powers did. Churchill and Roosevelt listened to Marshall and Alan Brooke. They had to argue with them across Green Bay's tables, face to face. Alan Brooke, the chief of the Imperial General Staff of Britain, would break pencils in half, saying, "No, I completely disagree with you, Prime Minister." And that simply didn't happen with men like Zeitzler and even Halder didn't do that to Hitler. Now, in Russia, which of course was also a totalitarian power and one in which Stalin had stopped himself from crushing and destroying Red Army morale, he killed 5 out of the 7 Red Army marshals between 1932 and 1939. He, as the war progressed, took on the Western, the Churchillian and Rooseveltian form of decision-making, rather than doing what one would have assumed he would have done, which would have been sticking to the totalitarian one, followed by Adolf Hitler. On the 22nd of June 1941, 40%, no less than 40% of the Russian bomber force was destroyed on the ground that first day of Operation Barbarossa. That evening, General Ivan Kopets, who was in charge of the Russian bomber force, committed suicide, which in Stalin's Russia is a sensible career move. There was a real sense that Stalin, by setting up the Stavka, the high command, and listening to the likes of Zhukov and Rokossovsky and Konev and the other great marshals, Vatutin before he was assassinated, actually was able to get over the initial instinctive assumptions that he must have made, not least because he had something approaching a mental breakdown for the first 10 days or a fortnight after Operation Barbarossa
took place anyhow. He simply couldn't believe that he had been betrayed in this way. And he was to adopt a much more collegiate approach to decision-making, on the understanding, of course, that at no stage did anybody pose, any soldier pose any political threat to him. If they had tried that, then they would have been made short order of. Maybe I think one last question. A gentleman here in the blue. Someone give him a... Thanks.
Thank you. During the time before the start in the war,
yeah,
why don't you address the position and the understanding of Hitler through leaders like Chamberlain or the other civilian in charge of the government he was going to attack? Because it's obvious that Chamberlain make a proposition, and through Chamberlain, Hitler misunderstood the position of England. So how do you address that?
Chamberlain misunderstood the
position. No, Hitler misunderstood, because, you know, England sent Chamberlain to do some kind of business. And so through Chamberlain, he misunderstood the position of the British position. So how do you address that situation?
Because it's not the case. And so what actually happened was that during the Munich crisis, before the war, the year before the war, in September 1938, Chamberlain did a deal with Adolf Hitler that the outlying areas of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, were going to be, rightly or wrongly, given back to Germany. But part of that deal was that the rest of Czechoslovakia was not going to be subsumed into the Third Reich, because that was racially not Aryan. It was instead the parts of Bohemia and Moravia and the rest of Czechoslovakia, which had nothing to do with the Germans racially. On the 15th of March 1939, i.e. only 6 months or so later, the Germans invaded the rump of Czechoslovakia and marched their troops through Prague, destroyed Czechoslovakian independence. And by the end of that month, on the night of the 31st of March 1939, Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, stood up in the House of Commons and made a guarantee to Poland. He guaranteed Polish independence and sovereignty. He said that if Germany was to invade Poland, then we, the British people, would go to war, and also the French supported this, that Britain and France would go to war against against Germany for Poland. On the night of the 1st of September, on the night of the 30th of August, stroke morning of the 1st of September 1939, despite this guarantee having been given in the House of Commons, publicly made the statement made and passed on to the German government, Hitler nonetheless invaded Poland. There was simply no question about what Britain had to do next. And what they did do was, after 48 hours of attempting to persuade the Germans to quit Poland, a completely quixotic and wasted period, in fact, although they had no other plans to attack Germany in the meantime, nonetheless, they made the declaration of war against Germany. So in no way was Neville Chamberlain misleading Hitler. He warned Hitler. He told Hitler what was going to happen if Hitler did a certain thing, which was to invade yet another Slavic, non-Aryan, non-German country. And when Hitler did it, he declared war, and the French declared war too. So it couldn't have been more straightforward. It couldn't have been more obvious. And it was supported by the whole of the rest of the civilized world. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.